I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Podsave the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Podsave the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Setlist, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Wiley, Twitter and the censorship debate. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when English music venues tested the viability of reopening again, but then weren't allowed to open anyway.
Yes, you may have noticed that in recent editions of Setlist, we've generally avoided talking in any great detail about COVID-19, the pandemic, the shutdown and the continued impact it is all having on the music industry. And partly that's because we've talked about it an awful lot and there's only so much you can say, particularly as many of the most interesting questions regarding COVID and the long-term impact on the music industry are those questions where the honest answer is, fuck knows. But actually, the main reason we've stopped talking about COVID stuff on Setlist is we record this podcast on a Friday morning, and every single week the UK government puts out a statement at Friday lunchtime or sort of late Thursday night or Friday evening.
Or on one occasion while we were recording.
Or on one occasion while we were actually recording. So that by the time the podcast goes out on Monday, it's out of date. Thanks, Boris Johnson, etc. Actually, this week, we've recorded for various technical reasons. We're still recording on Friday, but slightly later than normal. So that the announcement that was specifically timed to go out while we would have been recording the podcast went out before we were recording the podcast. And that is the announcement.
Ah, we got you, Boris.
We got you. And that was the announcement that the plan to allow indoor performances to return on the 1st of August, so tomorrow as we record this, 2 days ago as this podcast goes out, that plan that was announced a couple of weeks ago is now off. No indoor performances happening in England this weekend, next weekend. They reckon at least another 2 weeks before they'll allow indoor events and loads of other stuff as well that was going to restart in August is now not restarting in England. That's because of a recent sudden resurge of cases of COVID in certain areas, particularly in northern England. So they've decided to have a rethink across the country as a result of that. Although, as you also alluded to when you introed this little bit, most promoters and venue owners in England were kind of coming round to the opinion that even if indoor performances had started again on the 1st of August in England, there were sufficient social distancing rules still going to be in place that no one would have been able to run a gig anyway.
Yes, particularly after the Clapham Grand in, Clapham, put on a pilot gig at the request of the government to see what was viable. So Frank Turner headlined this show where they had 200 people in the venue, which normally holds 1,250. So that's a big drop. They laid it all out cabaret style with people sitting at tables, partly so that they could be 2 metres apart and partly so it didn't just look depressingly empty. And that all went ahead. There was a lot of talk about it beforehand, a lot of excitement. But then afterwards, the manager of the venue, Ali Wolf, said, this was not a success. We had lost money before we even opened the doors and before you even accounted for Frank Turner's fee.
Yes, I guess he meant it wasn't a commercial success. He didn't actually comment on whether or not the show worked. Actually, I quite like a cabaret-style show with lots of room, but I imagine quite a lot of Frank Turner fans would prefer to have something more like the classic gig experience. Also, all the drinks were waiter service, table service. Again, I quite like that.
But some might be annoying while you're trying to play a show, though.
So I don't actually know how it went in terms of the experience. Frank Turner gave an interview before the gig saying that it was exciting to get back on stage after being forced to be locked down for so long now. But certainly, yes, however the experience may or may not have been for either the people in the audience or the bands on stage, commercially, it doesn't work when you're operating at that lower capacity. Plus, they would need extra staff to do the table service. And then there was like a staggered entry system at the start of the night. There was a one-way system. Setting all of that is manpower. That's money. So yeah, he was basically saying it didn't work financially. And this is a venue which actually has quite a lot more space and flexibility than a lot of other music venues. So there's an element of, well, yeah, if you can't make it work at the Clapham Grand, you probably can't make it work at lots and lots of other venues. He did say they've actually got an upstairs. I don't think they've been using in the most recent iteration of the venue. So if they could get some tables and chairs up there, they've also been talking for a while about having, I think, a rooftop bar, which would be open air. So I think the optimist in him was saying, well, there's some stuff we were going to do to the venue anyway. And if we get that done, maybe it'll move it in the direction of being viable. But yeah, it didn't look like it was providing any kind of template that could be adopted by music venues all over the country to allow socially distanced indoor shows to happen. And even if it had, they still wouldn't be allowed.
No, but I mean, I think as we discussed however long ago it was now, because who knows how to judge a length of time anymore, but the possible viable option would be if you could have maybe your 20% capacity in the venue, and then you could sell tickets for a live stream as well. And that's the only way I can see it working with that lower number of people in a venue. Now, that relies on, obviously, people have been paying to live stream shows, but that still relies on every venue in the country being able to sell tickets to live streams. And it's probably questionable about whether or not that's a viable thing, because obviously normally you'd have an artist touring and going from place to place. But if everyone can get into one venue, then they have to just kind of pick which venue they like the most or they most like to see someone in. I don't know. It becomes more complicated once it becomes a full-scale thing. But I don't know. We will see what happens because, as you said, venues aren't allowed to open now anyway.
Yes, so all of those unknowns I alluded to earlier about how long COVID shutdown's going to continue for, are there any stopgap measures like the socially distant shows, the outdoor shows, maybe, yeah, this halfway house between having a super small audience in the building that you then live stream. The management company ATC is launching this week a brand new business to do ticketed live streams events. They having already done some shows like that, particularly with artists that they manage, like Nick Cave and Laura Marling. And what they're talking about is really interesting. We'll report on that in the CMU Daily, I'm sure, as the announcement goes out. So definitely keep an eye on that. So what they're doing is interesting. So there might be some interesting projects in the next few weeks, next few months, that bring a bit of positivity to this conversation. Although it has to be said, in the 48 hours before we've recorded this edition of Setlist, there's still plenty of doom and gloom when it comes to getting live music back up and running in any sort of commercially viable way anytime soon, certainly here in the UK. But, of course, we should stress that none of this is what we're here to talk about this week.
No, later on we'll be discussing the letter signed by a group of big-name musicians asking US politicians to please stop using their music without permission. But first, Wiley has been widely condemned by the music community and well beyond after a lengthy string of anti-Semitic posts on Twitter and Instagram recently. That rant saw him dropped by his management, A-List Management, and his distribution partner, ADA, and his former label, Big Dada, strongly criticised the rapper and pledged to donate all future royalties it received from his records to organisations that battle anti-Semitism.
Now, this was a really big story within the UK music industry and music community, and also just in the UK in general. So most of you are already probably very familiar with what Wiley was saying in this social media outburst, which involved, I mean, literally hundreds of posts. Initially to Twitter over a 48-hour period. There were then some videos posted initially to Instagram and then to YouTube. And along the way, in amongst all of that, I mean, it was quite hard to follow. It wasn't completely coherent, but along the way he made a number of problematic statements, spread various long debunked conspiracy theories, in particular some anti-Semitic conspiracy theories or a little bit of COVID stuff in there as well, and at one point he seemed to be advocating violence against Jewish people. So plenty of problematic stuff in there, but actually if you trace the whole thing back, I mean you can't anymore, because as we'll talk about, most of this has been deleted. But if you trace particularly the Twitter stuff all the way back to the start, it actually began with a couple of tweets that contained pretty common artist griping about the way that deals work in the music industry.
Yeah, that and some of his subsequent statements since then have suggested that the whole thing probably began as a falling out between Wiley and his manager, John Wolfe, who happens to be Jewish. In fact, Wiley has explicitly said that was the case in a Sky News interview recently. And as that Twitter storm began, Wolfe initially expressed concern about his client's mental health, but subsequently announced that he had formally ended his long-term partnership with the rapper entirely. Responding to that announcement, Wiley then said that it was him who had cut ties with Wolfe and not the other way around.
Yeah, and as you said, a couple of days after all of this had happened, he gave an interview to Sky News. And in that interview, he did issue a sort of partial apology. And in doing so, as you said, confirmed that there were definitely tensions between him and his management team before all of this began. And actually, those tensions probably contributed to the social media outburst. And he said to Sky News, "I just want to apologise for generalising and going outside of the people who I was talking to within the workspace and the workplace I work in. My comments should not have been directed to all Jews or all Jewish people. I want to apologise for generalising, and I want to apologise for comments that were looked at as anti-Semitic. My thing should have stayed between me and my manager. I get that now." So that's what he said in this Sky News interview. Although there was a partial apology in that interview, it has to be said what he said, it didn't really placate very many people.
No, because when you say, "I want to apologise for comments that were looked at as being anti-Semitic," that's never going to placate people because you were anti-Semitic. And so if you're not accepting that you were, then that's not really an apology. So that was an issue. But there's also, I mean, the fact that that interview and the tweets and the various Instagram posts and subsequent posts on YouTube, as he's lost access one by one to all of his social media accounts, were pretty erratic. And as I said, John Wolfe expressed concern about his mental health. I think a lot of people have expressed concern about his mental health as this has gone on, although obviously being anti-Semitic is not something you can explain away just by saying he's having a bad time. But it does seem that he probably does need some help. I mean, the person he needed to talk to was not a Sky News journalist, I think it's fair to say. I mean, what he said are things that he does need to apologise for and do need to be addressed. And I mean, there were other questions around that. Beyond the things that Wiley had said himself, there was the other important element to this story, which was how sites like Twitter and Instagram dealt with that outburst, because many people think that the response to that was far too slow.
Yes, and that sort of second side to this story, I think it's one of the reasons why it became such a big story beyond the music press, because it plays into an ongoing debate that is happening in the UK and the US, across Europe and elsewhere in the world at the moment, which is about the responsibility of platforms like Facebook, like Twitter, like YouTube, when people use those platforms to post content that is seen as being hateful or racist or anti-Semitic or abusive against either individuals or groups of individuals. So it plays very much into that debate. And actually, I think the reason why we've decided to talk about this on Setlist this week is less about the specifics around what is happening in Wiley's life at the moment, although obviously it was a very big music and music industry news story. But, you know, the bigger debate about what should a Twitter or a Facebook or an Instagram or a YouTube be doing when things like this happen? How do we decide when something is sufficiently offensive that it should be deleted or removed? When do we say that we should cut people's access off to these platforms? Who is even making these decisions? And how quickly can we expect these platforms to respond? Bearing in mind just how much content is going onto these sites and these apps and these services every single minute of every single day, how quickly can we expect any policies that these companies have to actually be realistically implemented? It's an incredibly tricky area that in itself has various different strands and elements to be discussed and to be debated. But as I say, it is very much a conversation that is ongoing within the political community at the moment, which is why very quickly this became a political story as well as a music story, as a number of politicians stepped forward. First of all, obviously, to criticise the more problematic things that Wiley had said, but actually, in many cases, to be even more critical about Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, etc.
Yeah, so various members of the UK government spoke out, including Home Secretary Priti Patel, who said in a tweet, "The anti-Semitic posts from Wiley are abhorrent. They should not have been able to remain on Twitter and Instagram for so long, and I have asked them for a full explanation. Social media companies must act much faster to remove such appalling hatred from their platforms." Meanwhile, London Mayor Sadiq Khan wrote a letter to Instagram CEO Adam Mosseri and Twitter's UK Managing Director Dara Nasir, saying, "When material which is clearly racist is shared on your platform, the response, its removal and the banning of those responsible should be immediate. You have invested in the technology and the people to make this possible," he added, "and there should be no excuses. It takes minutes for content shared on your platform to reach an audience of millions. When someone influential shares hate speech, in that time, it may have had an impact on the views of many who look up to them. Racism is not a grey area, and there is no room for interpretation in the kind of statements made by Wiley. It is particularly disheartening that at a time when social media has been playing such a positive role in amplifying the vital voices of the Black Lives Matter movement, we see again how it can be used to spread hatred and division."
So some bold statements and big demands being made by a political community there. Obviously, Priti Patel on the Conservative side, Sadiq Khan on the Labour side. So, you know, both sides of the political spectrum speaking out on this. But as I say, to an extent, I would disagree with Sadiq Khan, who is sort of presenting this as being a real clear-cut situation whereby things get posted, they're clearly problematic, they're clearly racist, they're clearly whatever, and the system should be in place to immediately delete them. But I mean, realistically, these things are rarely actually that clear cut, particularly as they're unfolding in real time. And I'm not saying that that's an excuse for either the people posting these statements or the platforms that allow those posts to appear. But I think pretending that it's clear cut isn't actually going to help us find a solution. And I said there was various different elements and strands to this debate. And I guess two key strands are, firstly, what does the law say? And or what should the law say? Now, obviously, we have one law in the UK that protects freedom of expression, protects free speech. Actually, that ultimately originates from the European Declaration on Human Rights. So it's a bit of European law, not EU law, but a bit of European law that provides a right in the Human Rights Act to freedom of expression and free speech. So the law is there to protect people when they want to say stuff. And whenever you get into the free speech debate, and as you know, this is one of my pet topics, I'm quite passionate on this issue, even though when you are a massive free speech defender, you nearly always end up having to defend, I don't know, the Daily Express or rappers who've said a load of stupid stuff online. But we do have this fundamental right to free speech, and there is the whole issue that there is no right not to be offended, and there is a right to offend, and quite where we draw the lines, it was really tricky. That said, if you go and read the European Declaration of Human Rights and or the Human Rights Act here in the UK, although there is a right to freedom of expression, there is then a bullet point list of exceptions to that general right of freedom of expression. And, you know, even in the US, where you have the First Amendment, which is a much stronger right to free speech than what we have here in Europe or here in the UK, I mean, any country, when you're protecting the right to free speech and freedom of expression, there will always be some limitations on that. And those limitations are very much in play here. But there is the question, well, what should those limitations be? What limitations are already in law? And first of all, quite what UK law currently says. There's plenty of ambiguity in that. There's plenty of debate. And then some people would say, well, current UK laws go too far or current UK laws don't go far enough. In terms of the things that Wiley said, yes, he was spreading a bunch of nonsense conspiracy theories, and some of those nonsense conspiracy theories were overtly anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. But I think the tweets where there is the strongest case for actually saying he was violating UK law were the couple of tweets where he seemed to be advocating violence against Jewish people, employing a little bit of slang in doing so. Although, when he was asked about that in the Sky News interview, he actually said that those specific tweets had been misconstrued.
So one of the specific comments that people were brought up as advocating violence against Jewish people was using the slang term "hold some corn," which can mean to receive bullets. But in the Sky News interview, he said that had been misconstrued. But when it was pointed out that even if that was the case, there was a risk that many of his fans might take it literally, Wiley played down his influence, arguing that he's now at the end of his musical career and that grime fans have moved on and no one's interested in what he says anymore.
But despite those comments, in a subsequent Sky News interview, various campaign groups have said that those were the tweets which, in their opinion, definitely pushed what Wiley was saying into the realm of breaching laws, particularly the laws against racial and religious hatred. And an organisation called the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, UK-based organisation, they made a formal complaint specifically over those remarks. And actually, as Wiley was still on social media posting, the Metropolitan Police in London confirmed that they had now received that complaint and that they were formally investigating whether or not a criminal offence under the laws against racial and religious hatred, whether an offence had been committed. So there is the legal dimension, both to the Wiley story, but more importantly to the wider debate as to when we should constrain the general right to freedom of expression where hateful content, offensive content, abusive content is being posted. It's very tricky. It's an ongoing debate. But I said there was two big strands. That's big strand number one. Big strand number two is, well, whatever the law says, what should Facebook do? And what should Twitter do? And what should YouTube do? Obviously, where the law is saying that this content is illegal, then in some ways for the social media companies, that's quite straightforward. They just need to be able to find that out super fast and then respond to it. The question is, well, what about that kind of content, which technically isn't illegal and you know, free speech vigilantes like me would say shouldn't be illegal for freedom of expression reasons, but just because something should be allowed in general under free speech rules doesn't mean it should necessarily be allowed on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, what is Facebook? It's a data marketing company that builds a database by providing free communication and publishing tools to people. And it's a corporate entity. It is for Facebook to decide who they both supply and deny those publishing and communication tools to. So even if we say beyond the incitement of violence, we have to be very careful about using the law to constrain what people are saying, even when what they are saying is nonsense or offensive or even arguably in the wrong hands dangerous. Even when we're concerned about having the law doing that, that doesn't mean that Facebook and YouTube and Instagram and Twitter couldn't be doing that themselves. And actually, there was a very interesting interview, again on Sky News, with the actress Tracy Ann Oberman, who over the last couple of years has been very vocal through her own social media about rising anti-Semitism in the UK. She was also one of the people who, after Wiley's outburst, advocated a 48-hour boycott of Twitter, basically because they had allowed Wiley to be posting for about 48 hours. But actually, she gave a really interesting, measured interview to Sky News, where she was basically saying she respects free speech rights, she respects freedom of expression, albeit with those legal constraints which we've already alluded to. But what she was kind of saying is, well, if Twitter and Facebook, etc., if they want to be anything goes platforms, platforms that say we stand up for free speech and literally anything goes on our platform, albeit within the strictest constraints of the law. And people can say whatever they like, they can say incorrect stuff, nonsense stuff, nasty stuff, hateful stuff. That's what we're all about. If that's what Facebook and Instagram and Twitter want to be, then let them be that. She's not saying they shouldn't be that. But her point was, they insist that that's not what they want to be, because actually, for commercial reasons, they can't be that. They need to offer a safe space for people to interact, to share content, for brands and celebrities to share content. It needs to be a safe place. It needs to be a reasonable place. And so what she was saying is Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, etc., for commercial reasons, insist that they do want a safe place. They don't want to be in anything goes. We accept any kind of offensive content. But what she was saying was, if that's the position you have made, and if people like her are therefore using these platforms because they feel comfortable using these platforms because that commitment has been made, once these companies have made that commitment, they need to have really clear policies in place as to how they're going to meet that commitment, and they need to make sure that they have the manpower and the technology to spot, remove and deal with problematic content as soon as it is posted. And even as a free speech vigilante, I thought that that was a very good point that she was making. And all of that will feed into this ongoing debate. I mean, this is not going anywhere. Despite all of the COVID distractions in the EU, in the UK, in the US, there are lots of conversations ongoing about what is often referred to as platform responsibility or how we change the law to reduce online harms. That's going to be a big talking point in political circles over the next couple of years. And yeah, over the last 10 days, a music industry story very much fed into that conversation.
As we record this, only YouTube is left as a platform that Wiley can use because over the course of last week, he was given a number of temporary bans, but ultimately Twitter, Instagram and Facebook all permanently banned him from their platforms. So he is no longer posting up there, but he is still posting on YouTube, which I guess, I mean, YouTube's had lots of debate about how it spreads conspiracy theories in recent times. So we'll see what happens there. But I don't think this is going to be the last we hear of this story. There's clearly more to come from it in terms of the debate it sparks about freedom of speech and platform responsibility, but also just what's happening with Wiley at the moment and what effect this has. As much as he was saying, my career's over anyway, I mean, that's not true. He does have a lot of fans who, a lot of them have been very disappointed to hear this sort of speech from Wiley recently. So it really remains to see what happens to him as a result of this and what greater implications it has for the online world. And finally, a group of musicians, including Elton John, Sia, Lorde, Linkin Park, REM, Pearl Jam and Alanis Morissette, have signed a letter calling on US politicians to stop using music in their political campaigns without asking first.
Yes, so this is the latest statement from music makers, albeit this time a lot of music makers, regarding the use of music by politicians at political events and rallies and also in content that they post online and to social media, etc., etc. This is not a new issue. It has happened for years. It's not a partisan issue, really. Artists sometimes get annoyed when those on the left use their music without permission in the same way they do when those on the right use their music without permission. Although, if we're being honest, although it's not a new issue and it's not a partisan issue, I mean, for a while now, this really has been about Donald Trump using music, particularly at his rallies, sometimes on social media, and then nearly every single artist whose music gets used getting really pissed off about that because they don't like the suggestion that either they associate with Donald Trump or they support Donald Trump, or even that they've given Donald Trump permission to use their music at his events. Now, we've been reporting on artists going public about their annoyance with Donald Trump using their music. I mean, we could almost have a weekly column and have several artists featured in it every week. We've reported on this a lot in the CME Daily. And also, you might remember very recently, the Rolling Stones put out a statement about this. They actually sent a cease and desist to the Donald Trump campaign and said that if he ever used their music again at one of his events, they would go legal. We talked about that on a very recent edition of Setlist. The legalities here are a little bit ambiguous. There is some grey area, particularly when music is used at events. Less so when it's used in videos. Quite straightforward copyright infringement if permission is not gained. But when it's played at events, there are complications. We talked about that very recently in the context of the Rolling Stones on a recent edition of Setlist, so we'll put a link in the notes to go back to that if you want to hear a discussion of the legal stuff. But this letter is interesting, so we thought we'd just spend a few minutes looking at the specifics of what this letter said. It touches on some copyright law stuff, it discusses some other legal stuff, and it even talks about morality.
Yes, so this letter was organised by the Artist Rights Alliance, a US trade body representing artists, as the name suggests. And the letter said, every election cycle brings stories of artists and songwriters frustrated to find their work being used in settings that suggest endorsement or support of political candidates without their permission or consent. Being dragged unwillingly into politics in this way can compromise an artist's personal values while disappointing and alienating fans, with great moral and economic cost. For artists that do choose to engage politically in campaigns or other contexts, this kind of unauthorised public use confuses their message and undermines their effectiveness. Music tells powerful stories and drives emotional connection and engagement, it says. That's why campaigns use it, after all. But doing so without permission siphons away that value.
The letter then goes on to discuss some of the legalities around all of this, which, as we've already said, they're actually quite ambiguous. in some cases more than others. Nevertheless, the letter says that when politicians use music without permission, particularly if they publish content online that uses music without permission, doing so can violate federal and in some cases state copyrights in both sound recordings and musical compositions. Depending on the technology used to copy and broadcast these works, multiple exclusive copyrights, by which they mean performing rights, mechanical rights, etc., may all be infringed. But, they said, it's not just copyright law, which is just as well, because as we say, in some circumstances, the copyright law is a little bit ambiguous. But they then listed a whole load of other areas of law that are possibly being breached and infringed when politicians use music without permission. So they said it might breach the creator's rights of publicity and branding. It may be a trademark infringement under America's Lanham Act. And it could also constitute false endorsement, conversion, and other common law and statutory torts. And who doesn't love a little bit of tort law? They even referenced the fact that with political campaigns, there's a whole load of extra rules and regulations around campaigns and how they're funded, and that maybe it could even be violating some of those campaign rules as well. So, lots of different legalities mentioned here, even though, as we've said several times, there is still some ambiguity, particularly when the music's being used at a live event.
Yes, which is possibly why they then finish off the letter by saying, and aside from all of that, it's immoral.
Dishonest and immoral, they said.
Yeah.
More importantly, the letter went, falsely implying support or endorsement from an artist or songwriter is dishonest and immoral. It undermines the campaign process, confuses the voting public, and ultimately distorts elections.
It should be anathema to any honest candidate to play off this kind of uncertainty or falsely leave the impression of an artist or songwriter's support, it says.
At the end of the letter, having dealt with the legalities and the morality side of all of this, they then move on to the PR bit. I don't know, maybe they think that some politicians, maybe one politician in particular, doesn't really care about legalities, certainly doesn't care about morality, but maybe they would accept the PR argument for not using an artist's music without permission, which basically is saying, whenever this happens and the politician uses the music without permission, and then the artist goes onto social media and complains about it and lays into the politician as a result, actually, the politician's reputation takes a knock and they are the bigger loser, ultimately.
Yes, the letter finished. No politician benefits from forcing a popular artist to publicly disown and reject them. And on social media and in the culture at large, it's the politicians that typically end up on the wrong side of these stories.
So there you go. Plenty of reasons why politicians in America specifically, although artists of the world would like politicians everywhere to listen to this, lots of reasons why politicians should stop using music without permission. Although it has to be said, certain politicians might find that if they start asking for permission to use music, there's not a great deal of music that they're able to use. As we say, not a new story, really. So many people have complained about this, certainly in the Trump era, but for years before as well, hasn't stopped politicians to date from using music without permission. Who knows if having a lot of artists all sign one letter will make any difference? We will see.
Yeah, but we can't sit and wait for that to happen now, because that is all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. Do remember to subscribe, rate and review the show. It really does help, other podcasts tell me. If you have a comment or question about anything we've discussed on this episode, you can email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk, and you will find links to everything we've discussed in this episode if you want to read more deeply into it in the show notes, which should be available in the podcast player you're listening to it now, and also at setlistpodcast.com. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Moulton, Chris Cook, and for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.
I'm Alastair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.